Well, hi, everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Chaffardini. Thank you so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. Oh, man, we have a banner episode, a great friend of the site, somebody who we've loved for years ever since the first musical notes came to our cerebrum and just stayed there rent-free. Welcome to the stage, the illustrious, the celebrated producer, conductor, composer, coach, teacher, father, the great Harry Gregson-Williams, everybody. From 1992 to the current time in history, more than 30 years, Harry has done it all and seen it all. He's written for puppets, princes, penguins, spies, snakes, Sinbad, lions, chickens, ogres, a BMW, rats, trains, cowboys, and aliens, and a scion of Santa Claus. He's been all over the globe. He's been to Narnia, Boston, China, Alcatraz, the jungle, the Arctic, Mars, the Holy Land, the past, the future. He's even been to the North Pole. Please help us welcome a great friend of the site, Harry Gregson-Williams. H, how are things in your world?
They're fine. Thank you very much. That was far too illustrious, but thank you for that. That's very kind of you. And yes, there've been a... Was it Stravinsky who said that my music is best understood by children and animals? I think maybe he said that. If he didn't, I just did. If he did, I'm sorry, I'm pilfering Stravinsky. But yeah, so yes, I have been around the houses a bit, but I feel pretty fresh and I need to. I've just embarked on Gladiator 2, which is a strange old one for me to take on, for me personally to take on. I mean, it's a great honor, and I'm thrilled to be doing it. But, you know, if you could pick a sequel to one of your old boss's movies, who went and won an Oscar for his contribution. Yeah, it's quite big shoes to fill, let's put it that way. But I'll do my best.
Well, geez, yeah, that is quite the elephant in the room to start with.
Going on in my life at the moment. So I've just spent some time with Ridley at his post-production place. Yeah, I think I know what I have to do now. It definitely is going to involve a lot of work, but I'm not scared of that. There's plenty that scares me, but not that. Yeah, so I've just embarked on that, and it's a great honor. And it is the third sequel I'm doing in a row. I mean, I've done, you know, obviously I did the Shreks and the Narnias and I don't know what else, but yes, I've done the Meg 2 in the last 12 months, it seems. Chicken Run 2, which seems like the paint is just drying on that one. And here we are on Gladiator 2. So I hope one day to be asked to do a film that's a fresh idea. Maybe it'll never happen. I hear there's a Shrek 5 in the works, but I don't think I'll be doing that. I think Shrek and I have been buddies for a long time. It's probably time for somebody else to have a go at that. But we'll see. So yes, here we are on Gladiator 2.
As I mentioned, you know, you've been in the business more than 30 years. Does it seem weird to you that, I mean, the movie, as far as I can remember, has been talked about possibility in production? I mean, how did it all of a sudden land and manifest?
Well, it's these things are never very predictable with his Ridley-ness, because, you know, he and this is no criticism, actually. It's a fair play to him. You know, he's Van Gellist himself, he's Zimmered himself, he's Goldsmithed himself, he's Hornered himself, he's Cornered himself. Now, you know, he's been around the houses, and, you know, I've been very fortunate to do three or four with him. And his previous film was done by Martin Phipps, a really good English composer. I don't think I've met him, but I spoke to him, and sounds like a really nice guy, and clearly very talented. I mean, he did Napoleon. But previous to that, I did Gucci and The Last Duel. And then before that, I think Daniel Pemberton did a couple. So he, you know, he picks and chooses his team. And, you know, if one's lucky enough to get a call, which I did, then off we go to the races.
Well, you kind of have an in with the Scott family. And that's one thing I've always wanted to, you know, What was the point in time where you realized, you may get a call, you may get a script or something, but at what point do you just, you meet Tony and you're like, I think we're going to be best friends? Or how does, what was that galvanizing point in your career?
Well, yes, I'm as you point out, I certainly met Tony before I met Ridley. And I met Tony probably in about 1997. I was working for maybe 96. I was working for Hans Zimmer's assistant at the time, and we were working on a film, probably my least favorite film actually of any Scott brother, called The Fan. That was kind of a mean movie. About a really mean guy, was it played by De Niro? Was like an overly zealous baseball fan. But Hans was doing it. Why was Hans doing it? Because he'd done Tony's previous films and done a couple with Ridley, so he was embedded in the Scott family. Yeah, I popped up on the radar. I suppose I'd been with Hans a year or two. Assisting him, learning the business, and doing the best I could, and suddenly we were doing that film, which scared me because the score that Hans was doing was going to be very synthy, very little orchestra, if any, and I'd only just begun really to experiment with synths myself, having had a pretty classical, I suppose you could say, conventional musical education to that point, but I was fascinated with synths, and Hans was at the time was really the master of that manipulation of synths in his scores, and he had all these wires going, well, they were like trip wires. You walked into his room, which I usually would do around about midnight because I would work the night shift, or at least the night shift with Hans could begin at 3 a.m. because he liked to burn the candle at both ends. Yeah, what one and I had seen Tony come and go, but Hans included me in the meetings that he had in the reviews, so I was able to say at least say hello to Tony. But I know years later when someone sent me an interview that Tony had done, and he'd been asked how he'd first met me, Harry. He said that he walked into Hans's room on the fan, and there was some bag of bones asleep on the couch. And there was no Hans, but there was this skinny little bloke just trying to get some kip on the couch. I do remember that. I remember being woken up and thinking, oh my God, well, this is probably the end of my American adventure. This guy's not going to take kindly to that. He kind of prodded me, and told me I looked like crap and I needed a coffee or something like that. And yeah, probably not in those words. And then Hans showed up. He had been a bit late or delayed or something like that. We got on with the meeting, and it was kind of the denouement of The Fan, and I witnessed something I hadn't witnessed before, which was Hans having a cue rejected, and I thought he was the master and the king, and there was no way that anybody would want to, or dare I say, dare to reject a cue, but in the nicest possible way. I mean, they were big buddies; they'd worked together a lot, those two. But it was tense, and it just wasn't working for Tony. Whatever it was, I don't recall. Oh, it was a scene in a baseball stadium. I think it was the denouement of the movie. Hans was pretty wrecked. We'd been working really hard. Perhaps he was surprised, and I learned a lot from those moments because rather than get all defensive and shitty about it, Hans stood up for what he believed. But that wasn't going to work with Tony on that occasion, and it was decided he'd come back the next day and hear something different, and I can't remember how it was, but precisely, but Hans immediately reviewed the concept for whatever it was he was trying to do in that scene and got to work on it. And later that day he said to me, look, I've got a map of something from A to B here, you'll need to finish it by the time I get back, in the morning or whatever it was. But even going into Hans's composing room at that stage, it was like there were tripwires across. He had sort of leads going, I don't know, MIDI leads flying around here, various things, audio lines go, inputting into special delays or special reverbs, none of which I understood at all. And I probably tripped on one and I put it back in the wrong hole. But it was quite nerve-wracking working in it. Up to that point, I had worked a bit in Hans's room. I was beginning to get my own room together within his facility there, mostly with secondhand gear that didn't work of his, because I didn't have any money. I had no way of buying all this gear. Yeah, so I kind of got to work on the thing, and the next day, I don't know how well I did, but when Hans came in, it was done, or it was he was able to finish what or get it into the right spot. And Tony came and he signed off on it, and so that was quite. And Hans wasn't he was never was back in the day backwards and going forwards with he shining a light on me if I did something good. He let Tony know that I'd been a little elf in the night. I was quite surprised at that. So I guess I was on Tony's radar, but not as a composer, not as an option for composer, because he had Herr Zimmer. Why would you need anybody else? But I think one thing led to another, and Enemy of the State was around the corner for Tony, and for whatever reason, Hans wasn't going to do it, and agreed to kind of loan me out. As I think Jerry Bruckheimer had met Trevor Rabin on a film sometime before. And actually, what preceded all this, I think, was I ended up working with Trevor on Armageddon. And Jerry was somehow involved in that, who I'd met when I'd worked on The Rock. So all this, it's a tapestry of sort of opportunities and chance meetings and not messing it up too badly, but I think it all goes it sh sh serves as a salutary lesson to anybody starting off in any part of the business in Hollywood. A lot of it is about relationships, I think. And I obviously I'm a beneficiary of that, in so much as I met Tone and he trusted me with Enemy of the State, albeit with a co-composer, with Trev, who I loved from Armageddon. We got on so well. And after that, he trusted me with the score myself. I did Spy Game and then Man on Fire and Domino and I don't know everything until the day he died. But in amongst that somewhere, I think I was sitting in my room as quite a time after I left Hans's studio, and got my own studio on Venice Beach. I got a call one night. I was working late, and fancy that. And I got a call one night from an old friend who had been Hans's tech, actually, when I first showed up at Media Ventures back in 1995. Nice bloke called Mark Streitenfeld, and we'd become quite good friends, really good friends. And he'd finished being the tech, and he'd sort of graduated to being a music editor. He called me and said, "Look, I'm in London with Ridley Scott, and I just got to give you a heads up. He's listening to some CDs tonight because, and this was the first film that Rid was going to do after Gladiator, which obviously was hugely successful for all of them, including Hans." Excuse me. He said, "Look, he's listening to CDs. I think he's got," and he rattled off a few rather well-known composers. "And he's listening to some of your stuff." So I said, "Well, oh man, wow, me? Really?" Anyhow, he said, "Look, if you get a call from Ridley Scott, that's probably what it's going to be about." Sure enough, I don't know, a couple of days later, I did indeed get a call from him. So I immediately called Tony, and he said, I kind of wanted to just check it out and see if I had his blessing. And he said, "Yeah, sure, but you better be back for Domino. Because it's So I think there was a sort of yeah, it was a schedule made, but because Ridley wanted me to go over, go over to London to compose, not just to record the score, and I had just finished spending a lot of money and time and effort setting up my studio in Venice, here in LA. So everything had to be unplugged and put into flight cases, and I disappeared for 6 months to do Kingdom of Heaven with Ridley, but was back to do Domino. So that was quite a year, because I think after that I did Shrek 2. So I think I went Ridley, Tony, Jeffrey Katzenberg. So that was quite a menu for to fulfill. So that's where the first film I did with Tone was Enemy of the State with Trevor Rabin. And then the first film I did with Ridley was Kingdom of Heaven. And as I say, Tone didn't look back. I never got a call from my agent or anything like that. It was Tony who called me and said, "You better have got some sleep, because we're going with," and then he'd name the next film, Deja Vu, or whatever it was. Indeed, the last time I spoke to him, called me and said, "I'm scouting in Northern California for Top Gun 2. You better have had some rest," or something like that. And with Ridley, as I say, I've been really fortunate to do some beautiful films with him. I love Kingdom of Heaven, and I adored doing The Martian. I helped out a bit on Prometheus and Exodus, Gods and Kings, although I wasn't the principal composer on those films. And in a couple of other things, the Life in the Day movies, we did two of them 10 years apart, actually. And then, obviously, more recently, The Last Duel, which I know very few people saw. If they did, they might not have got it terribly well or enjoyed it. But I love that movie. Writing music for Ridley's Images. This it's always a freezing cold morning, just pre-dawn. Horses are riding through a wood. The light is blue. The frost is tingling on the trees. It's unbelievable. It's just yeah. It's just art, really. His films are, you could freeze frame any moment in any of these films, and just admire what you're looking at. So yeah, on The Martian, I got a script. He said, "I because I, you know, after Kingdom of Heaven, actually, Mark Streitenfeld went on to compose scores for him, the very same music editor who called me on Kingdom of Heaven." So yeah, there was an interval of some time. I think I did a Life in the Day movie for him. Contributed to that, and then I got a script that kind of dropped on my doormat, and on the front said something like, "Read it, like it, don't fuck it up." And that was from Ridley, and yeah, no, it was perfect, because I read the script in one gulp, and wow, it was so good, it was so tense, so funny. And then the movie turned out to be so well acted, so well cast, and of course looked beautiful. Darius Volsky, cinematographer, Pietro Scalia, editor, what a team. And off we went on that one. And as I told you earlier, I think Daniel Pemberton's done a couple, and recently Martin did Napoleon. So yeah, I don't take anything for granted. If I got a call from Red, I feel very fortunate.
Well, it's kind of mind-boggling how many things are moving at any given point in time, whether it's a development or post-production, and somebody comes on early, somebody comes on late. It's but what you kind of alluded to a long time ago is that you're planting seeds for relationships that, you impress somebody, whether with your stature or your sleeping or your editing capabilities or your, composition, and next thing you know, you're doing whatever it is. And so I
Well,
actually didn't.
I think the other thing to add to that is, and I think a lot of composers who've been fortunate to sort of get into a groove of a career would attest to this, is that I think the early years, if we can call them that, and by the way, I was in my mid-30s when I showed up here. I'd had a life and a career doing something quite different. I mean, in music, okay, but not film music. Yeah, I think the important thing in those early years, if one's lucky enough to find a mentor like I did, or have a mentor dig you out, which is probably more accurate in my case, but I think learning as much and being learning as much as quickly as possible, and there's no better way than actually learning on the job, as it were. Someone says, "Okay, I want you to do this. I'll see you tomorrow morning." There's no real option other than to get it done. But I think in order to be able to grab an opportunity, if one does arise, if and when one arises, I think the huge important thing is to make sure that all the tools that you're going to need to be able to proceed are intact, and that you've armed yourself with the kind of artillery you're going to need, as best you can, rather than waiting for the opportunity, thinking, "Well, it's never going to come. Ah, it always goes to James Newton Howard, or so and so is going to get this film. It's never going to come to me." But I think using the time and the early years, to just be to be as ready as possible for when that crumb does drop from a table, that you're there to catch it, and you're there as prepared as you can possibly be in order to, give a good showing of yourself.
Well, let's go back to that specific cue that was rejected.
When I say rejected, it was probably more answered. I don't recall particularly what it was, but
Okay.
I know alarm bells rang briefly at Media Ventures. But as I say, the way that Hans dealt with it, well, it really impressed me and showed me, there's no point in throwing your toys out of the pram. There's usually a good reason for a director to say that's not quite what I need. It may not be what he's looking for. It may just not be what he needs. And these pushbacks do they come. They come fairly often. And when they come, one's got to be able to deal with them in a mature and productive way.
But in terms of maybe the quantity of work, is it a 30-second cue? Is it a suite? What? And it doesn't have to be that specific one, but if something does need to be reworked, is there a length of time that you usually have? I mean, I know it's impossible
Well, no, I
to.
mean, I think it's all different things. I mean, I think in an ideal world, one's given enough time to be able to make the odd mistake, and to be able to beat a hasty retreat, back down the path that you've gone, and back to the crossroads, and maybe take an alternative route. On occasion, there's going to be very little time to do that. But then I think that's another thing that we can all learn from. The masters at this, and Hans certainly is one of those, that time management's pretty damn critical. When one's got a gig, one's got a pretty good idea, at that point, when you're engaged as a composer, what the post-production schedule is. The first thing I look at is what date is the first date, the first day of the final dub, the final mix for the film going to be. When let's see, on Chicken Run 2, for instance, I gave myself plenty of time. Now, it depends. If you're the sort of composer who wants to take on four things at once, then you're going to get shafted at some stage. On Chicken Run 2, I had June 2023 on hold at Abbey Road, about 6 months in advance. That's when I knew I had to record it, because I could see that they needed me to deliver the music in July. So I'm not gonna record a movie that needs to be delivered in July in February. Why would I? And I'm not gonna book August for it either. Backing up from there. So okay, I gotta deliver the music in July. It means I gotta record it and mix it in June, which means I got to have it signed off on before the end of May, which means I got started in January, I think. I think I started before the holidays in 2022. So time management's pretty critical in this business, because Yeah, there's no button that has a action queue written on it, which you can just press and out it comes. Depending on the sort of film you're doing, I mean, Chicken Run's a good example of that's got to have a lot of notes in it. Animation usually does. Ask John Powell. yeah, some people write more notes than others. But yeah, if they're going to be a lot of notes, you do need you need plenty of time. And there are some occasions, you know, I've had a couple of occasions where I haven't had much time. On one occasion, I had a ludicrously small amount of time and had to get a whole group and team of people together to help me put it off. That was Team America, World Police. But that was very unusual. You know, they'd let go of their composer very late in the day. There was no time, maybe two and a half, 3 weeks or something silly to do 80, 90 minutes of music. You know, it's just not possible for one person to do it. Keep the quality up anyhow. So yeah, I had my old assistant Steve Jablonski helped out a lot. Trevor Rabin, anybody I knew actually, anybody who could possibly offer up something. So that was that. But for instance, on Prometheus, no, I was pulled in very late by Ridley. I was asked if I would write a theme and variations, which he could then kind of insert into his film. And I think when I met him on that film, when he called me and said, "Can you come and have a look at it?" He was here in LA. I went right to his office and he said, "Can I come and hear the theme tonight?" So I scuttled back to my lair in Venice and knocked out a theme. And you know, he came once he was happy with that. He felt it was the right theme. He pretty much left me to it. But I had about a week to write 20 minutes of music, the variations on that theme, to picture, to try, you know, where he'd said, "Look, we want it here." And then I was on a plane to Abbey Road, I think 2 days recording, maybe only one, quick mix, and that was it. So that's very unusual. And that's not a score. That was a contribution to a score. But when I was talking about trying to build a coherent musical journey throughout a film, yeah, you're going to need some time.
You know, you mentioned Chicken Run, which is I'm really glad to be speaking with you about the sequel. I'm so glad that after 20 years we have a follow-up.
Yes.
So what you and John Powell did was kind of like a take on The Great Escape. There was I believe there were fifes, and it was kind of a World War II type thing. Now it's, you know, gets into the 60s a little bit. Can you talk about that? It wasn't really like reinventing yourself. It felt like a whole new score. So what was kind of your and Sam's
It was good.
discussions?
Yeah, I mean, the intention was that it should be obviously a fresh, a new and tailor-made score for this film, but to embrace the anything from the first score. And you know, I loved working with John on that. He wrote some cracking cues on that movie. And so, where appropriate, I mean, it didn't work like a cut and paste, I can assure you. But you know, I would take a melody, the main theme actually from the first movie, and manhandle it into the score. And the filmmakers were really wanted that sort of warm and fuzzy feeling of familiarity of that. But yeah, obviously there was a slightly different take on this because the chickens are trying to get into somewhere as opposed to get out. So it was less The Great Escape, more Mission Impossible, yeah, that kind of thing. But no, it was great fun to do. I walk over mountains to work with Aardman again. Yeah, I've had great fun working with them, and so no, so they're so sort of individual and unique in what might be seen as quite a sea of mediocrity in this business. There's nothing mediocre about Aardman. I mean, the time and effort that goes into making a movie like in the way that they make movies, it's quite extraordinary. Quite extraordinary. And it's fascinating, really. But also that, you know, the out and out English humor. I can't deny I've been in the States, what, 27 years now. I have six American children. I'm very much embedded here. But I do love me a good English movie with a little silly English humor in it. So I was very, very, very happy to be doing that.
I'm going to throw lavish praise on you for Kingdom of Heaven and Enemy of the State, Spy Game, The Martian. But I do love Arthur Christmas. I do love
Ah,
Early Man, and I do.
that's how nice of you to say so, because I loved that film. I absolutely adored that film. And I actually have a couple of lines in that that me and my children still use. What is it? What's it? One of my kids said it to me the other day. Oh, yeah. Mind your baubles. Sorry. Yeah, mind your baubles. I thought it was a great achievement because it remained a very Aardman-esque film, yet it was computer generated, very much like Flushed Away, which I'd done for them a few years before that, I think.
When I spoke to Steve Jablonsky about his work, he says he
Yeah,
gets
Jablonski.
into I love talking to him, I love talking to you, especially about how your careers have intertwined. I even told him the story about when you told him that he's too good, he needs to get out on his own and stop
Oh,
messing
yeah.
around underneath their tables. He's like, wow, that's such a great story. But he gets into the world of sound engineering, and there's some parts in Dawn of the Nugget that I'm wondering if you had any input into, little bleeps, little things that weren't music but might have been necessary for the atmosphere.
No, man, no. In Chicken Run, absolutely not. But in a movie, I don't know, a movie like what I'd do in the middle of last year, or was it the year before? It was a Liam Neeson thing called Retribution. A little scene movie, but lovely director, fantastic director. I hope I work with him again. Really great guy. But in a movie like that, so it's a thriller. It's basically Phone Booth, but in a car. I mean, it's mostly synth. There's very little orchestra going on in there. And quite often, the whole premise of it is there's a ticking bomb, as is the way in some of these type of movies. So the music had to provide that kind of metronome, that kind of tension throughout the movie. And there are all sorts of ways that one could use, I guess you'd call them sound designy methods within the score. When the viewer sees the movie and hears the soundtrack, it's probably not clear what's music and what's a sound effect in some places. No, I think as composers who like to dabble in that a little bit, and I'm one of those, Jablonski is probably another one. I think often when we're criticized for the, oh, where's the theme? Where's the, yeah. But it's horses for courses. It's, I don't believe a movie like what I've just described, I don't know, Retribution or Phone Booth, say, for instance, could or should be scored with an orchestra. And with a thematic approach, it doesn't need that. It's going to be very distracting to have that. Having said that, I do thoroughly believe in thematic material, and I hope that movies like Shrek or Narnia, or Kingdom of Heaven, and certainly Gladiator to come, and many, 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 many movies that I do and others do, yeah, they're theme led, and very much orchestrally led. But I don't think it's necessary all the time to think that that's has to be the case. So, yes, we fiddle about with synthesizers and wherever we can make noises that help tell the story and bring a full enjoyment to the viewer. I think that's what we have to do. And actually, that's the joy of doing such a varied amount of scores. I'd hate to have been pigeonholed way back when, and find myself just doing horror movies or just doing animation or just doing thrillers like I've described.
If you also think about what happened too, I mean, like movies with the same director, but they're wildly different. Last Duel is very different from The House of Gucci.
Yeah.
Martian is different from now Gladiator 2. And so, I really like, it was really impressive to hear the music for Retribution. Tracks like Change of Plan and He Will Rise. It reminded me of The East, which I love, and also Spy Game. And it helps keep you fresh, I would imagine. A
Yeah,
little bit here, a
it
little bit there.
does. And taking a different approach does indeed keep you fresh and on your toes. It's not always possible to or even desirable to be going down the same path every time. But with a filmmaker like Ridley Scott, that the yes, The Last Duel and The House of Gucci, two films I did in the row, couldn't be more different. And couldn't have required more of a different approach from me. One of them had quite a bit of music, and the other one had very little score needed from me. Had a bunch of songs. So, each task is very different. And with animation, I always remember Jeffrey Katzenberg saying to John Powell and me when we set sail on Ants, and we were kind of confused as to what direction we should be taking, as you'd imagine, as pretty much beginners as we were. And he said, "Oh, just imagine this is Romancing the Stone. You know, it's a love story. You know, got a dysfunctional Woody Allen, and you know, a gorgeous Sharon Stone, but they just happen to be ants." So, you know, the putting that way into perspective was really helpful. It's like, okay, well, let's just find the heart of this story, and the heartbeat of it, and run with that. And the fact that they're ants, or they were chickens a little bit later, or whether ogres, it really makes very little difference. You know, technically, maybe a little difference as functional differences in how one approaches actual scoring the thing, but in terms of what one's trying to deliver, which is a really well thought out piece of story making, then there's no real difference between live action and some of these animations that we've all done.
One thing I do want to acknowledge is how much I love the Gilded Age and getting to work with your brother on that. I want to ask, just as a consumer, we know nothing about the creative process. We know very little about the placement or the directive to place cues. But from the very first note of the opening credits, you have to imagine, okay, there's got to be something before that. Was that a segment of a bigger suite? Because it seems too robust to just drop right into the intro of a show. Can you break down that intro to us?
Yeah, no, I think how that got, yeah, no, it was a great fun working with Rupert, my brother. It wasn't our first rodeo. We had worked for George Clooney doing Catch 22 a couple of years before that, and we were looking out for something different that we could team up on. And I can't remember how it came about, but I have a feeling it was something like, because he Rupert has a different agent to me, so I don't necessarily know what he's doing. Well, he doesn't know what I'm doing. He also lives in England, and I'm here in LA. So although we're in constant touch, I don't necessarily know what he's up for and what he's not. But I don't know how it went. But I think he might have mentioned to me he was up for this HBO thing, which is written by Julian Fellowes. And I had just put the phone down to my agent, who had said, "I think you're on a short list for this Gilded Age thing." So I said, "Well, hold on a second, Ruth. Are we talking about the same thing?" So we went away and spoke to our respective agents, and yes, it's a short list of three. So we're like, "Well, Christ, let's outmaneuver whoever the third person is and offer them two for the price of one." And that's what we did. I don't know who the unfortunate third person, the third wheel was. Yeah, so that came out kind of accidentally. We were looking for something to do together, but it wasn't like we targeted that. But yeah, the opening title of that was actually a piece that we had written in advance of scoring the first episode. So we didn't get the main title images until when we were, I think we were well into scoring the, writing the score for the first episode. And then they came up with these images. And obviously, it wanted to be energetic. And I think Rue had said to me, that piece that we did for such and such a scene, I think we could maybe be able to adapt to that. And it would be kind of cool because that had turned into the sort of thematic material that we're using as the theme for the show. So it would be neat to put it into the opening title. So yes, the cart came before the horse in that instance. The idea for the main title had been punched out in a scene during the first episode. I don't recall which, but certainly not in the manifestation that it became. But I think the robust kind of that little riff, I think we'd worked out for some other spots. So we adapted that, and we had great fun doing that, actually. We were very lucky with that. But because of the time difference between our two composing environments, him being in England and me being here, we managed to make that work for us pretty damn well. Because, I would work on a cue. I mean, we were together in the same room at the very beginning of the process. We sat around a piano and bashed out some themes that we thought might be really good. And then we split up. He went back to his to where he is, and I would, here in LA, I'd come to the end of my day, my working day, in the evening, and I'd post up to him any ideas I'd had. And as I slept, he'd be waking up, and he'd take something and run with it, or post up something for me to hear when I on my breakfast table. So we it was kind of like a 24-hour
That's
engine.
cool. Yeah.
Well, we made it work for us. And believe me, the amount of music in that show, my God, thank goodness we had two pairs of hands, because I mean, he's done much more TV than I have, and he's more experienced at the swift turnover that has to happen. But no, we would have been a shocker to have been on that alone. I wouldn't have liked that. I would not have liked it, not enjoyed that at all. I mean, we would be writing one episode on a Monday and probably have a meeting on the Wednesday to sign off on that. The following day, be recording another episode and mixing for the next 3 days whilst spotting the next episode, and then having to present the final, and so it went on for weeks. So it was actually really, really good that there were two of us to maneuver around that schedule. But yeah, no, it's great fun. In fact, we just heard it got picked up for season 3, so we're going
Oh.
to be off the races again.
Well, it ended on quite an inspirational or positive note for
Well, you've got to take your hat off to HBO as well, because a show like that, it can't be cheap to make, the costumes and the locations, and there's quite a big cast there. And from our perspective, for every episode, which might have 40 minutes of music in it, we got a really nice orchestra and time to record the orchestra, mix it really well. This wasn't all done in a box, and I'm sure some TV shows are, and that's just the way that they're fixed up financially. But we felt very fortunate, because we got to record everything exactly how we would want to record it, and in the manner that deserved to be recorded.
when I listen to your music, whether it is spies, whether it is synths, whether it is silliness, there's always a heartfelt element. And so I'm looking at scores like Dawn of the Nugget. There's a part where it's very foreboding and ominous using strings and horns. But conversely, to the Gilded Age, you have something that feels like very lush. It has to follow the narrative. So when someone says the word lush to you, I guess first of all, was that used in the keywords? And two, what does that mean to you? Is it note?
The name of my current favorite synth, Lush.
Okay.
A good synth, yeah. Well, on a show like that, we were very fortunate to have a gr really good showrunner who really looked after us, was very clear about the direction that we should go, and that we could go. I think that probably made a huge difference to our enjoyment as well, and to the results as well, because I'm sure. There are occasions where a composer would tell you that it's quite possible to get quite lost in amongst all the sea of music and the hectic schedule. But no, we were guided really well by the showrunner on that show. And there were obvious scenes that needed to be lush, as you say, and quite a few scenes that kind of needed music that would purr along gently underneath and not underpin the humor too much, just let that happen. But did have an emotional, some emotional content to it. And we were able to write themes that that everybody liked at HBO, and we were able to lean on those. Yeah, it was good fun.
So there's a wonderful line in the show that says, it will not be luxurious, but you won't be destitute. So have you ever heard that from the mouth of producer saying, "Hey, H, welcome to the club. Please score this for me. Here's your fee. It will not be luxurious, but you won't be destitute."
No, I can't say I have, but going into something like this, as I say, they got two for the price of one, so this wasn't something that was gonna necessarily pay the rent. No, this is done for purely for love and for the challenge, and the chance to get to work with my brother once again. So we'll see. Maybe there's something more in the future. Although we, as I say, we've been recently told that they picked up the show for another season, so we'll be at it again fairly shortly, I suppose. I don't know. I don't know what the schedule is. No one's mentioned it yet.
Well, I know in the past, you mentioned Last Duel, and this is from the consumer. This is the first time I've actually noticed outside of maybe independent films, the composer or the studio giving credit to key musicians. I saw quite a few musicians listed in the credits of The Last Duel. And is that something that is becoming more common to celebrate the orchestra and the players?
I don't know. Quite often the studios are quite mean with the amount of lines, as they call them, that we're allowed. You know, there've been occasions where years ago now, I can remember a couple of friends helped out on a film, doing some beats for me for a particular scene, and I'd promised them that you know, obviously I paid them well and they had a great time. And they did what I wanted them to do. And I had promised them that I would try and get them an additional music credit. So on that particular film, which doesn't matter what film it was, but with that studio, so I put in my credits as one does towards the end of the process, you know, that when they're going to shoot those credits. I put in my credits, which included these two lads who had contributed. And I don't know, about 6 months later, I guess the film's released in England or wherever it was that they saw it, and their names were nowhere to be seen. They were like, "Come on, Harry, what the hell are you doing?" I was like, "Man, I had no idea. I mean, I didn't watch the film to the end of the credits. I know I gave my credits in." But it turns out that studio are bloody mean with the amount of lines, and they just basically said, "Yeah, or whatever it said, you know, music editor or orchestrator or da-da-da-da, whatever I'd put in," they just thought, "Well, that's enough. That's enough for the music." Well, you know, and just left off those names. So ever since that time, I make sure that I check before I promise anybody anything. I'll check that I'm allowed enough space in that end crawl to be able to credit people properly. And sometimes, as you pointed out, you can list a whole orchestra. The credit situation, I mean, that's real estate right there. I mean, it's important to understand that you know, screen time is costing the money or whatever it is. But yeah, I'm very careful as to how I approach the studios about that, and I love to give credit where credit's due. But yeah, in terms of crediting a whole orchestra, that's kind of rare.
Well, H,
I
it's
think.
been tremendous catching up with you. We know you need to either sleep or work in Gladiator 2. I think I know what has priority, but we wish you the very best. This has been an awesome catching up.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been really fun talking to you. Maybe speak to you after Gladiator.
I look
Folks.
forward to it. And until that time, we will catch you next time.